File 16.
The mental horizon of the German-Austrian was comparatively broad. His commercial interests comprised almost every section of the heterogeneous empire. The conduct of almost all important undertakings was in his hands. He provided the state, for the most part, with its leading technical experts and civil servants. He was responsible for carrying on the foreign trade of the country, as far as that sphere of activity was not under Jewish control. The German-Austrian exclusively represented the political cement that held the state together. His military duties carried him far beyond the narrow frontiers of his homeland. Though the recruit might join a regiment made up of the German element, the regiment itself might be stationed in Herzegovina, as well as in Vienna or Galicia. The officers in the Habsburg armies were still Germans, and so was the predominating element in the higher branches of the civil service. Art and science were in German hands, apart from the new artistic trash which might easily have been produced by a Negro tribe. All genuine artistic inspiration came from the German section of the population. In music, architecture, sculpture, and painting, Vienna abundantly supplied the entire dual monarchy, and the source never seemed to show signs of a possible exhaustion. Finally, it was the German element that determined the conduct of foreign policy, though a small number of Hungarians were also active in the field. All efforts, however, to save the unity of the state were doomed to end in failure because the essential prerequisites were missing. There was only one possible way to control and hold in check the centrifugal forces of the different and differing nationalities. This way was to govern the Austrian state and organize it internally on the principle of centralization. In no other way imaginable could the existence of that state be assured. Now and again, there were lucid intervals in the higher ruling quarters when this truth was recognized. But it was soon forgotten again, or at least deliberately ignored, because of the difficulties to be overcome in putting it into practice. Every project which aimed at giving the empire a more federal shape was bound to be ineffective, because there was no strong central authority which could exercise sufficient power within the state to hold the federal elements together. It must be remembered in this connection that conditions in Austria were quite different from those which characterized the German states as founded by Bismarck. Germany was faced with only one difficulty, which was that of transforming the purely political traditions, because throughout the whole of Bismarck's Germany there was a common cultural basis. The German Empire contained only members of one and the same racial or national stock, with the exception of a few minor foreign fragments. Demographic conditions in Austria were quite the reverse. With the exception of Hungary, there was no political tradition, coming down from a great past, in any of the various affiliated countries. If there had been, time had either wiped out all traces of it, or at least rendered them obscure. Moreover, this was the epoch when the principle of nationality began to be in ascendant, and that phenomenon awakened the national instincts in the various countries affiliated under the Habsburg scepter. It was difficult to control the action of these newly awakened national forces, because, adjacent to the frontiers of the dual monarchy, new national states were springing up, whose people were of the same or kindred racial stock as the respective nationalities that constituted the Habsburg Empire. These new states were able to exercise a greater influence than the German element. Even Vienna could not hold out for a lengthy period in this conflict. When Budapest had developed into a metropolis, a rival had grown up, whose mission was not to help in holding together the various divergent parts of the empire, but rather to strengthen one part. Within a short time, Prague followed the example of Budapest, and later on came Lemberg, Laibach, and others. By raising these places, which had formerly been provincial towns, to the rank of national cities, rallying centres were provided for an independent cultural life. Through this, the local national instincts acquired a spiritual foundation, and therewith gained a more profound hold upon the people. The time was bound to come when the particularist interests of those various countries would become stronger than their common imperial interests. Once that stage had been reached, Austria's doom was sealed. The course of this development was clearly perceptible since the death of Joseph II. Its rapidity depended on a number of factors, some of which had their source in the monarchy itself, while others resulted from the position which the empire had taken in foreign politics. It was impossible to make anything like a successful effort for the permanent consolidation of the Austrian state, unless a firm and persistent policy of centralization were put into force. Before everything else, the principle should have been adopted that only one common language could be used as the official language of the state. Thus, it would be possible to emphasize the formal unity of that imperial commonwealth, and thus the administration would have in its hands a technical instrument without which the state could not endure as a political unity. In the same way, the school and other forms of education would have been used to inculcate a feeling of common citizenship. Such an objective could not be reached within 10 or 20 years. The effort would have to be envisaged in terms of centuries. Just as in all problems of colonization, steady perseverance is a far more important element than the output of energetic effort at the moment. It goes without saying that in such circumstances the country must be governed and administered by strictly adhering to the principle of uniformity. For me, it was quite instructive to discover why this did not take place, or rather why it was not done. Those who were guilty of the omission must be held responsible for the breakup of the Habsburg Empire. More than any other state, the existence of the old Austria depended upon a strong and capable government. The Habsburg Empire lacked ethical uniformity, which constitutes the fundamental basis of a national state, and will preserve the existence of such a state, even though the ruling power should be grossly inefficient. When a state is composed of a homogeneous population, the natural inertia of such a population will hold the state together and maintain its existence through astonishingly long periods of misgovernment and maladministration. It may often seem as if the principles of life had died out in such a body politic, but a time comes when the apparent corpse rises up and displays before the world an astonishing manifestation of its indestructible vitality. But the situation is utterly different in a country where the population is not homogeneous, where there is no bond of common blood, but only that of one ruling hand. Should the ruling hand show signs of weakness in such a state, the result will not be to cause a kind of hibernation of the state, but rather to awaken the individual instincts which are slumbering in the ethnological groups. These instincts do not make themselves felt as long as these groups are dominated by a strong central will to govern. The danger which exists in these slumbering separate instincts can be rendered more or less innocuous only through centuries of common education, common traditions, and common interests. The younger such states are, the more their existence will depend on the ability and strength of the central government. If their foundation was due only to the work of a strong personality, or a leader who is a man of genius, in many cases they will break up as soon as the founder disappears, because, though great, he stood alone. But even after centuries of a common education and experience, these separatist instincts I have spoken of are not always completely overcome. They may be only dormant, and may suddenly awaken when the central government shows weakness, and the force of a common education, as well as the prestige of a common tradition, prove unable to withstand the vital energies of separatist nationalities forging ahead towards the shaping of their own individual existence. The failure to see the truth of all this constituted what may be called the tragic crime of the Habsburg rulers. Only before the eyes of one Habsburg ruler, and that for the last time, did the hand of destiny hold aloft the torch that threw light on the future of his country. But the torch was then extinguished for ever. Joseph II, Roman Emperor of the German nation, was filled with a growing anxiety when he realized the fact that his house was removed to an outlying frontier of his empire, and that the time would soon be at hand when it should be overturned and engulfed in the whirlpool caused by that Babylon of nationalities, unless something was done at the 11th hour to overcome the dire consequences resulting from the negligence of his ancestors. With superhuman energy, this friend of mankind made every possible effort to counteract the effects of carelessness and thoughtlessness of his predecessors. Within one decade, he strove to repair the damage that had been done through centuries. If destiny had only granted him 40 years for his labours, and if only 2 generations had carried on the work which he had started, the miracle might have been performed. But when he died, broken in body and spirit, after 10 years of rulership, his work sank with him into the grave, and rests with him there in the Capuchin crypt, sleeping its eternal sleep, having never again showed signs of awakening. His successors had neither the ability nor the willpower necessary for the task they had to face.